"Vegeta procleator životnoi," he said through his teeth as he saw me. But at the same moment, with a mighty sound of crunching and crashing stones, two authentic Tatars came running down to the rescue, and I trudged on with my butterfly net toward the upper crags where the Yuxian race of the Hippolyte Grayling was expecting me. In that summer of 1918, a poor little oasis of miraged youth, my brother and I used to frequent the amiable and eccentric family who owned the coastal estate Oles. A bantering friendship soon developed between my coeval Lydia T. and me. Many young people were always around, brown-limbed, braceleted young beauties. A well-known painter called Sorin, actors, a male ballet dancer, merry white army officers, some of whom were to die quite soon, and what with beach parties, blanket parties, bonfires, a moon-spangled sea, and a fair supply of Crimean Muscat Lunel, a lot of amorous fun went on. And all the while, against the frivolous, decadent, and somehow unreal background, which I was pleased to believe conjured up the atmosphere of Pushkin's visit to the Crimea a century earlier, Lydia and I played a little oasal game of our own invention. The idea consisted of parodizing a biographic approach projected, as it were, into the future, and thus transforming the very specious present into a kind of paralyzed past as perceived by a doddering memoirist who recalls through a helpless haze his acquaintance with a great writer when both were young. For instance, either Lydia or I, it was a matter of chance inspiration, might say on the terrace after supper, "The writer liked to go out on the terrace after supper," or, "I shall always remember the remark V.V. made one warm night. It is," he remarked, "a warm night." Or, still sillier, "He was in the habit of lighting his cigarette before smoking it." All this delivered with much pensive, reminiscent fervor which seemed hilarious and harmless to us at the time. But now I catch myself wondering if we did not disturb unwittingly some perverse and spiteful demon. Through all those months, every time a bag of mail managed to get from the Ukraine to Yalta, there would be a letter to me from my Sinara. Nothing is more occult than the way letters, under the auspices of unimaginable carriers, circulate through the weird mess of civil wars. But whenever, owing to that mess, there was some break in our correspondence, Tamara would act as if she ranked deliveries with ordinary natural phenomena such as the weather or tides, which human affairs could not affect, and she would accuse me of not answering her, when in fact I did nothing but write to her and think of her during those months, despite my many betrayals. 5. Happy is the novelist who manages to preserve an actual love letter that he received when he was young within a work of fiction, embedded in it like a clean bullet in flabby flesh, and quite secure there among spurious lives. I wish I had kept the whole of our correspondence that way. Tamara's letters were a sustained conjuration of the rural landscape we knew so well. They were, in a sense, a distant but wonderfully clear antiphonal response to the much less expressive lyrics I had once dedicated to her. By means of unpampered words, whose secret I failed to discover, her high school girlish prose could evoke with plangent strength every whiff of damp leaf, every autumn-rusted frond of fern in the St. Petersburg countryside. "Why did we feel so cheerful when it rained?" she asked in one of her last letters, reverting, as it were, to the pure source of rhetorics. "Boja moi, mon Dieu, rather than my God, where has it gone, all that distant, bright, endearing? Vzioye to dalyokoi, svetloi, miloi." In Russia, no subject is needed here, since these are neuter adjectives that play the part of abstract nouns, on a bare stage, in a subdued light. Tamara, Russia, the wildwood grading into old gardens, my northern birches and firs. The sight of my mother getting down on her hands and knees to kiss the earth every time we came back to the country from town for the summer. Et la montagne, et le grand chêne. These are things that fate one day bundled up pell-mell and tossed into the sea, completely severing me from my boyhood. I wonder, however, whether there is really much to be said for more anesthetic destinies, for, let us say, a smooth, safe, small-town continuity of time, with its primitive absence of perspective, when at 50 one is still dwelling in the clapboard house of one's childhood, so that every time one cleans the attic one comes across the same pile of old brown schoolbooks, still together among later accumulations of dead objects, and where on summery Sunday mornings one's wife stops on the sidewalk to endure for a minute or two that terrible, garrulous, dyed, church-bound McGee woman, who, way back in 1915, used to be pretty, naughty Margaret Ann of the mint-flavored mouth and nimble fingers. The break in my own destiny affords me, in retrospect, a syncopal kick that I would not have missed for worlds. Ever since that exchange of letters with Tamara, homesickness has been with me a sensuous and particular matter. Nowadays, the mental image of matted grass on the Yala, of a canyon in the Urals, or of salt flats in the Aral region, affects me nostalgically and patriotically as little or as much as, say, Utah. But give me anything on any continent resembling the St. Petersburg countryside, and my heart melts. What it would be actually to see again my former surroundings, I can hardly imagine. Sometimes I fancy myself revisiting them with a false passport under an assumed name. It could be done. But I do not think I shall ever do it. I have been dreaming of it too idly and too long. Similarly, during the latter half of my 16-month stay in the Crimea, I planned for so long a time to join Denikin's army, with the intention not so much of clattering astride a chamfrained charger into the cobbled outskirts of St. Petersburg, my poor Yuri's dream, as of reaching Tamara in her Ukrainian hamlet, that the army ceased to exist by the time I had made up my mind. In March of 1919, the Reds broke through in northern Crimea, and from various ports a tumultuous evacuation of anti-Bolshevik groups began. Over a glassy sea in the Bay of Sebastopol, under wild machine-gun fire from the shore, the Bolshevik troops had just taken the port, my family and I set out for Constantinople and Piraeus, on a small and shoddy Greek ship, Nadezhda, Hope, carrying a cargo of dried fruit. I remember trying to concentrate as we were zigzagging out of the bay on a game of chess with my father. One of the knights had lost its head, and a poker chip replaced a missing rook, and the sense of leaving Russia was totally eclipsed by the agonizing thought that, Reds or no Reds, letters from Tamara would be still coming, miraculously and needlessly, to southern Crimea, and would search there for a fugitive addressee, and weakly flap about like bewildered butterflies set loose in an alien zone at the wrong altitude among an unfamiliar flora. Chapter 13. 1. In 1919, by way of the Crimea and Greece, a flock of Nabokovs, three families in fact, fled from Russia to Western Europe. It was arranged that my brother and I would go up to Cambridge on a scholarship awarded more in atonement for political tribulations than in acknowledgement of intellectual merit. The rest of my family expected to stay for a while in London. Living expenses were to be paid by the handful of jewels which Natasha, a far-sighted old chambermaid just before my mother's departure from St. Petersburg in November 1917, had swept off a dresser into a necessaire, and which for a brief spell had undergone interment, or perhaps some kind of mysterious maturation, in a Crimean garden. We had left our northern home for what we thought would be a brief wait, a prudent perching pause on the southern ledge of Russia. But the fury of the new regime had refused to blow over. In Greece, during two spring months, braving the constant resentment of intolerant shepherd dogs, I searched in vain for Gruner's Orange Dip, Heldreich's Sulphur, Kreuper's White. I was in the wrong part of the country. On the Cunard liner Pannonia, which left Greece on May 18, 1919, 21 years too soon as far as I was concerned, for New York, but let us off at Marseille, I learned to foxtrot. France rattled by in the cold black night. The pale channel was still oscillating inside us when the Dover-London train quietly came to a stop. Repetitive pictures of gray pears on the grimy walls of Victoria Station advertised the bath soap English governesses had used upon me in my childhood. A week later, I was already shuffling cheek to cheek at a charity ball with my first English sweetheart, a wayward, willowy girl 5 years my senior. My father had visited London before, the last time in February 1916, when, with five other prominent representatives of the Russian press, he had been invited by the British government to take a look at England's war effort, which it was hinted did not meet with sufficient appreciation on the part of Russia's public opinion. On the way there, being challenged by my father and Kornei Chukovsky to rhyme on Africa, the poet and novelist Alexei Tolstoy, no relation to Count Lyov Nikolaevich, had supplied, though seasick, the charming couplet, Vizhu palmu I kafrika, yeto Afrika. I see a palm and a little kaffir. That's Africa. In England, the visitors had been shown the fleet. Dinners and speeches had followed in noble succession. The timely capture of Erzurum by the Russians, and the pending introduction of conscription in England, "Will you march too, or wait till March too," as the punning posters put it, had provided the speakers with easy topics. There had been an official banquet presided over by Sir Edward Grey, and a funny interview with George V, whom Chukovsky, the enfant terrible of the group, insisted on asking if he liked the works of Oscar Wilde. "The works of U. Wald," the king, who was baffled by his interpreter's accent and who anyway had never been a voracious reader, neatly countered by inquiring how his guests liked the London fog. Later, Chukovsky used to cite this triumphantly as an example of British cant, tabooing a writer because of his morals. A recent visit to the public library in New York has revealed that the above incident does not appear in my father's book, Izvoyuyushche Angli, Petrograd, 1916, a report on England at war. And indeed, there are not many samples therein of his habitual humor beyond, perhaps, a description of a game of badminton, or was it fives, that he had with H.G. Wells, and an amusing account of a visit to some first-line trenches in Flanders, where hospitality went so far as to allow the explosion of a German grenade within a few feet of the visitors. Before publication in book form, this report appeared serially in a Russian daily. There, with a certain old-world naivete, my father had mentioned making a present of his Swan fountain pen to Admiral Jellicoe, who at a table had borrowed it to autograph a menu card, and had praised its fluent and suave nib. This unfortunate disclosure of the pen's make was promptly echoed in the London papers by a Maybe Todd and Company Limited advertisement, which quoted a translation of the passage and depicted my father handing the firm's product to the commander-in-chief of the Grand Fleet under the chaotic sky of a sea battle. But now there were no banquets, no speeches, and even no fives with Wells, whom it proved impossible to convince that Bolshevism was but an especially brutal and thorough form of barbaric oppression, in itself as old as the desert sands, and not at all the attractively new revolutionary experiment that so many foreign observers took it to be. After several expensive months in a rented house in Elm Park Gardens, my parents and the three younger children left London for Berlin, where, until his death in March 1922, my father joined Josef Hessen, a fellow member of the People's Freedom Party, in editing a Russian émigré newspaper, while my brother and I went to Cambridge, he to Christ College, I to Trinity. 2. I had two brothers, Sergei and Kirill. Kirill, the youngest child, 1911 to 1964, was also my godson, as happened in Russian families. At a certain stage of the baptismal ceremony in our Vera drawing-room, I held him gingerly before handing him to his godmother, Ekaterina Dmitrievna Danzas, my father's first cousin and a grandniece of Colonel K.K. Danzas, Pushkin's second in his fatal duel. In his childhood, Kirill belonged, with my two sisters, to the remote nurseries which were so distinctly separated from his elder brother's apartments in townhouse and manor. I saw very little of him during my 2 decades of European expatriation, 1919 to 1940, and nothing at all after that, until my next visit to Europe in 1960, when a brief period of very friendly and joyful meetings ensued. Kirill went to school in London, Berlin, and Prague, and to college at Louvain. He married Gilberte Barbanson, a Belgian girl, ran, humorously but not unsuccessfully, a travel agency in Brussels, and died of a heart attack in Munich. He loved seaside resorts and rich food. He loathed, as much as I do, bullfighting. He spoke 5 languages. He was a dedicated, practical joker. His one great reality in life was literature, especially Russian poetry. His own verse reflects the influence of Gumilyov and Hodasyevich. He published sparsely and was always as reticent about his writing as he was about his persiflage misted inner existence. For various reasons, I find it inordinately hard to speak about my other brother. That twisted quest for Sebastian Knight, 1940, with its gloriettes and self-mate combinations, is really nothing in comparison to the task I balked in the first version of this memoir, and am faced with now. Except for the 2 or 3 poor little adventures I have sketched in earlier chapters, his boyhood and mine seldom mingled. He is a mere shadow in the background of my richest and most detailed recollections. I was the coddled one, he the witness of coddling. Born caesareanly, 10.5 months after me, on March 12, 1900, he matured earlier than I, and physically looked older. We seldom played together. He was indifferent to most of the things I was fond of, toy trains, toy pistols, red Indians, red admirables. At 6 or 7, he developed a passionate adulation, condoned by Mademoiselle, for Napoleon, and took a little bronze bust of him to bed. As a child, I was rowdy, adventurous, and something of a bully. He was quiet and listless, and spent much more time with our mentors than I. At 10 began his interest in music, and thenceforth he took innumerable lessons, went to concerts with our father, and spent hours on end playing snatches of operas on an upstairs piano well within earshot. I would creep up behind and prod him in the ribs. A miserable memory. We attended different schools. He went to my father's former gymnasia, and wore the regulation black uniform to which at 15 he added an illegal touch, mouse-gray spats. About that time, a page from his diary that I found on his desk and read, and in stupid wonder showed to my tutor, who promptly showed it to my father, abruptly provided a retroactive clarification of certain oddities of behavior on his part. The only game we both liked was tennis. We played a lot of it together, especially in England, on an erratic grass court in Kensington, on a good clay court in Cambridge. He was left-handed. He had a bad stammer that hampered discussions of doubtful points. Despite a weak service and an absence of any real backhand, he was not easy to beat, being the kind of player who never double faults and returns everything with the consistency of a banging wall. In Cambridge we saw more of each other than anywhere before, and had for once a few friends in common. We both graduated in the same subjects, with the same honors, after which he moved to Paris, where during the following years he gave lessons of English and Russian, just as I did in Berlin. We again met in the 1930s, and were on quite amiable terms in 1938 to 1940 in Paris. He often dropped in for a chat, Rue Boileau, where I lodged in 2 shabby rooms with you and our child, but it so happened he had been away for a while that he learned of our departure to America only after we had left. My bleakest recollections are associated with Paris, and the relief of leaving it was overwhelming, but I am sorry he had to stutter his astonishment to an indifferent concierge. I know little of his life during the war. At one time he was employed as translator at an office in Berlin. A frank and fearless man, he criticized the regime in front of his colleagues, who denounced him. He was arrested, accused of being a British spy, and sent to a Hamburg concentration camp, where he died of inanition on January 10, 1945. It is one of those lives that hopelessly claim a belated something, compassion, understanding, no matter what, which the mere recognition of such a want can neither replace nor redeem. 3. The beginning of my first term in Cambridge was inauspicious. late in the afternoon of a dull and damp October day, with a sense of indulging in some weird theatricals, I put on my newly acquired dark bluish academic gown and black square cap for my first formal visit to E. Harrison, my college tutor. I went up a flight of stairs and knocked on a massive door that stood slightly ajar. "Come in," said a distant voice with hollow abruptness. I crossed a waiting room of sorts and entered my tutor's study. The brown dusk had forestalled me. There was no light in the study, save for the glow of a large fireplace near which a dim figure sat in a dimmer chair. I advanced, saying, "My name is," and stepped into the tea-things that stood on the rug beside Mr. Harrison's low wicker armchair. With a grunt, he bent sideways from his seat to right the pot, and then scooped up and dumped back into it the wet black mess of tea leaves it had disgorged. Thus the college period of my life began on a note of embarrassment, a note that was to recur rather persistently during my 3 years of residence. Mr. Harrison thought it a fine idea to have one white Russian lodge with another, and so at first I shared an apartment in Trinity Lane with a puzzled compatriot. After a few months he left college, and I remained sole occupant of those lodgings. They seemed intolerably squalid in comparison with my remote and by now non-existent home. Well do I remember the ornaments on the mantelpiece, a glass ashtray with the Trinity crest left by some former lodger, a seashell in which I found the imprisoned hum of one of my own seaside summers, and my landlady's old mechanical piano, a pathetic contraption full of ruptured, crushed, knotted music which one sampled once and no more. Narrow Trinity Lane was a staid and rather sad little street with almost no traffic, but with a long, lurid past beginning in the 16th century when it used to be Fine Silver Lane, although commonly called at the time by a coarser name because of the then abominable state of its gutters. I suffered a good deal from the cold, but it is quite untrue, as some have said it, that the polar temperature in Cambridge bedrooms caused the water to freeze solid in one's washstand jug. As a matter of fact, there would be hardly more than a thin layer of ice on the surface, and this was easily broken by means of one's toothbrush into tinkling bits, a sound which in retrospect has even a certain festive appeal to my Americanized ear. Otherwise, getting up was no fun at all. I still feel in my bones the bleakness of the morning walk up Trinity Lane to the baths, as one shuffled along, exuding pallid puffs of breath in a thin dressing gown over one's pajamas and with a cold, fat sponge bag under one's arm. Nothing in the world could induce me to wear next to my skin the woolies that kept Englishmen secretly warm. Overcoats were considered sissy. The usual attire of the average Cambridge undergraduate, whether athlete or leftist poet, struck a sturdy and dingy note. His shoes had thick rubber soles, his flannel trousers were dark gray, and the buttoned sweater, called a jumper, under his Norfolk jacket was a conservative brown. What I suppose might be termed the gay set wore old pumps, very light gray flannel trousers, a bright yellow jumper, and the coat part of a good suit. By that time my youthful preoccupation with clothes was on the wane, but it did seem rather a lark, after the formal fashions in Russia, to go about in slippers, eschew garters, and wear one's collar sewn onto one's shirt, a daring innovation in those days. The mild masquerade in which I indolently joined has left such trifling impressions upon my mind that it would be tedious to continue in this strain. The story of my college years in England is really the story of my trying to become a Russian writer. I had the feeling that Cambridge and all its famed features, venerable elms, blazoned windows, loquacious tower clocks, were of no consequence in themselves, but existed merely to frame and support my rich nostalgia. Emotionally, I was in the position of a man who, having just lost a fond kinswoman, realized, too late, that through some laziness of the routine-drugged human soul, he had neither troubled to know her as fully as she deserved, nor had shown her, in full, the marks of his not quite conscious then, but now unrelieved affection. As with smarting eyes I meditated by the fire in my Cambridge room, all the potent banality of embers, solitude, and distant chimes pressed against me, contorting the very folds of my face as an airman's face is disfigured by the fantastic speed of his flight. And I thought of all I had missed in my country, of the things I would not have omitted to note and treasure had I suspected before that my life was to veer in such a violent way. To some of the several fellow émigrés I met in Cambridge, the general trend of my feelings was so obvious and familiar a thing that it would have fallen flat and seemed almost improper if put into words. With the whiter of those white Russians, I soon found out that patriotism and politics boiled down to a snarling resentment which was directed more against Kerensky than against Lenin, and which proceeded solely from material discomforts and losses. Then, too, I ran into some quite unexpected difficulties with such of my English acquaintances as were considered to be cultured and subtle and humane, but who, for all their decency and refinement, would lapse into the most astonishing drivel when Russia was being discussed. I want to single out here a young socialist I knew, a lanky giant whose slow and multiple manipulations of a pipe were horribly aggravating when you did not agree with him and delightfully soothing when you did. With him I had many political wrangles, the bitterness of which invariably dissolved when we turned to the poets we both cherished. Today he is not unknown among his peers, which is, I readily admit, a pretty meaningless phrase. But then I am doing my best to obscure his identity. Let me refer to him by the name of Nesbit, as I dubbed him, or affirm now having dubbed him, not only because of his alleged resemblance to early portraits of Maxim Gorky, a regional mediocrity of that era, one of whose first stories, My Fellow Traveler, another apt note, had been translated by a certain R. Nesbit Bain, but also because Nesbit has the advantages of entering into a voluptuous palindromic association with Ibsen, a name I shall have to evoke presently. It is probably true, as some have argued, that sympathy for Leninism on the part of English and American liberal opinion in the 20s was swung by consideration of home politics. But it was also due to simple misinformation. My friend knew little of Russia's past, and this little had come to him through polluted communist channels. When challenged to justify the bestial horror that had been sanctioned by Lenin, the torture house, the blood-bespattered wall, Nesbit would tap the ashes out of his pipe against the fender knob, recross sinisterly his huge, heavily shod, dexterously crossed legs, and murmur something about the Allied blockade. He lumped together, as Tsarist elements, Russian émigrés of all hues, from peasant socialist to white general, much as today Soviet writers wield the term fascist. He never realized that had he and other foreign idealists been Russian in Russia, he and they would have been destroyed by Lenin's regime as naturally as rabbits are by ferrets and farmers. He maintained that the reason for what he demurely called less variety of opinion under the Bolsheviks than in the darkest Tsarist days was the want of any tradition of free speech in Russia, a statement he got, I believe, from the sort of fatuous Dawn in Russia stuff that eloquent English and American Leninists wrote in those years. But the thing that irritated me perhaps most was Nesbit's attitude toward Lenin himself. All cultured and discriminating Russians knew that this astute politician had about as much taste and interest in aesthetic matters as an ordinary Russian bourgeois of the Flaubertian épicier sort, the type that admired Pushkin on the strength of Tchaikovsky's vile librettos, wept at the Italian opera, and was allured by any painting that told a story. But Nesbit and his highbrow friends saw in him a kind of sensitive, poetic-minded patron and promoter of the newest trends in art, and would smile a superior smile when I tried to explain that the connection between advanced politics and advanced art was a purely verbal one, gleefully exploited by Soviet propaganda, and that the more radical a Russian was in politics, the more conservative he was on the artistic side. I had at my disposal a number of such truths that I liked to air, but that Nesbit firmly entrenched in his ignorance regarded as mere fancy. The history of Russia, I might, for example, declare, could be considered from two points of views, both of which for some reason equally annoyed Nesbit. First, as the evolution of the police, a curiously impersonal and detached force, sometimes working in a kind of void, sometimes helpless, and at other times outdoing the government in brutal persecution. and second, as the development of a marvelous culture. Under the Tsars, I might go on, despite the fundamentally inept and ferocious character of their rule, a freedom-loving Russian had had incomparably more means of expressing himself, and used to run incomparably less risk in doing so than under Lenin. Since the reforms of the 1860s, the country had possessed, though not always adhered to, a legislation of which any Western democracy might have been proud. A vigorous public opinion that held despots at bay, widely read periodicals of all shades of liberal political thought, and what was especially striking, fearless and independent judges. Oh, come, Nesbitt would interpose. When revolutionaries did get caught, banishment to Tomsk or Omsk, now Bomsk, was a restful vacation in comparison to the concentration camps that Lenin introduced. Political exiles escaped from Siberia with farcical ease. Witness the famous flight of Trotsky, Santa Leo, Santa Claus Trotsky, merrily riding back in a Yuletide sleigh drawn by reindeer, on Rocket, on Stupid, on Butcher and Blitzen. I soon became aware that if my views, the not usual views of Russian Democrats abroad, were received with pained surprise or polite sneers by English Democrats in situ, another group, the English ultra-conservatives, rallied eagerly to my side, but did so from such crude reactionary motivation that I was only embarrassed by their despicable support. Indeed, I pride myself with having discerned even then the symptoms of what is so clear today, when a kind of family circle has gradually been formed, linking representatives of all nations, jolly empire builders in their jungle clearings, French policemen, the unmentionable German product, the good old church-going Russian or Polish pogromstchik, the lean American lyncher, the man with the bad teeth who squirts anti-minority stories in the bar or the lavatory, and at another point of the same subhuman circle, those ruthless, paste-faced automatons in opulent, John-held trousers and high-shouldered jackets, those sits-reason looming at all our conference tables whom, or shall I say, which, the Soviet state began to export around 1945 after more than two decades of selective breeding and tailoring, during which men's fashions abroad had had time to change, so that the symbol of infinitely available cloth could only provoke cruel derision, as occurred in post-war England when a famous Soviet team of professional soccer players happened to parade in mufti. 4. Very soon I turned away from politics and concentrated on literature. I invited to my Cambridge rooms the vermilion shields and blue lightning of the Song of Igor's Campaign, that incomparable and mysterious epic of the late 12th or late 18th century, the poetry of Pushkin and Tuchev, the prose of Gogol and Tolstoy, and also the wonderful works of the great Russian naturalists who had explored and described the wilds of Central Asia. At a bookstall in the marketplace, I unexpectedly came upon a Russian work, a second-hand copy of Dahl's Interpretive Dictionary of the Living Russian Language in 4 volumes. I bought it, and resolved to read at least 10 pages per day, jotting down such words and expressions as might especially please me, and I kept this up for a considerable time. My fear of losing, or corrupting through alien influence, the only thing I had salvaged from Russia, her language, became positively morbid and considerably more harassing than the fear I was to experience 2 decades later of my never being able to bring my English prose anywhere close to the level of my Russian. I used to sit up far into the night, surrounded by an almost quixotic accumulation of unwieldy volumes, and make polished and rather sterile Russian poems, not so much out of the live cells of some compelling emotion, as around a vivid term or a verbal image that I wanted to use for its own sake. It would have horrified me at the time to discover what I see so clearly now, the direct influence upon my Russian structures of various contemporaneous Georgian English verse patterns that were running about my room and all over me like tame mice, and to think of the labor I expended. Suddenly, in the small hours of a November morning, I would become conscious of the silence and chill. My second winter in Cambridge seems to have been the coldest and most prolific one. The red and blue flames wherein I had been seeing a fabled battle had sunk to the lugubrious glow of an arctic sunset among hoary firs. Still, I could not force myself to go to bed, dreading not so much insomnia as the inevitable double systole, abetted by the cold of the sheets, and also the curious affection called anxietas tibiarum, a painful condition of unrest, an excruciating increase of muscular sense, which leads to a continual change in the position of one's limbs. So I would heap on more coals and help revive the flames by spreading a sheet of the London Times over the smoking black jaws of the fireplace, thus screening completely its open recess. A humming noise would start behind the taut paper, which would acquire the smoothness of drum skin and the beauty of luminous parchment. Presently, as the hum turned into a roar, an orange-colored spot would appear in the middle of the sheet, and whatever patch of print happened to be there, for example, the League does not command a guinea or a gun, or the revenges that Nemesis has had upon Allied hesitation and indecision in Eastern and Central Europe, stood out with ominous clarity until suddenly the orange spot burst. Then the flaming sheet, with the whir of a liberated phoenix, would fly up the chimney to join the stars. It cost one a fine of 12 shillings if that firebird was observed. The literary set, Nesbitt and his friends, while commending my nocturnal labors, frowned upon various other things I went in for, such as entomology, practical jokes, girls, and especially athletics. Of the games I played at Cambridge, soccer has remained a wind-swept clearing in the middle of a rather muddled period. I was crazy about goalkeeping. In Russia and the Latin countries, that gallant art had been always surrounded with a halo of singular glamour. Aloof, solitary, impassive, the crack goalie is followed in the streets by entranced small boys. He vies with a matador and the flying ace as an object of thrilled adulation. His sweater, his peaked cap, his knee guards, the gloves protruding from the hip pocket of his shorts, set him apart from the rest of the team. He is the lone eagle, the man of mystery, the last defender. Photographers, reverently bending one knee, snap him in the act of making a spectacular dive across the goal mouth to deflect with his fingertips a low, lightning-like shot, and the stadium roars in approval as he remains for a moment or two lying full length where he fell, his goal still intact. But in England, at least in the England of my youth, the national dread of showing off and a too grim preoccupation with solid teamwork were not conducive to the development of the goalie's eccentric art. This, at least, was the explanation I dug up for not being over-successful on the playing fields of Cambridge. Oh, to be sure, I had my bright, bracing days. The good smell of turf, the famous inter-varsity forward dribbling closer and closer to me with the new tawny ball at his twinkling toe, then the stinging shot, the lucky save, its protracted tingle. But there were other, more memorable, more esoteric days, under dismal skies, with the goal area a mass of black mud, the ball as greasy as a plum pudding, and my head racked with neuralgia after a sleepless night of verse-making. I would fumble badly and retrieve the ball from the net. Mercifully, the game would swing to the opposite end of the sodden field. A weak, weary drizzle would start, hesitate, and go on again. With an almost cooing tenderness in their subdued croaking, dilapidated rooks would be flapping about a leafless elm. Mists would gather. Now the game would be a vague bobbing of heads near the remote goal of St. John's or Christ, or whatever college we were playing. The far blurred sounds, a cry, a whistle, the thud of a kick, all that was perfectly unimportant and had no connection with me. I was less the keeper of a soccer goal than the keeper of a secret. As with folded arms I leant my back against the left goalpost, I enjoyed the luxury of closing my eyes, and thus I would listen to my heart knocking and feel the blind drizzle on my face and hear, in the distance, the broken sounds of the game, and think of myself as of a fabulous exotic being in an English footballer's disguise, composing verse in a tongue nobody understood about a remote country nobody knew. Small wonder I was not very popular with my teammates. Not once in my 3 years of Cambridge, repeat, not once did I visit the university library, or even bother to locate it. I know its new place now, or find out if there existed a college library where books might be borrowed for reading in one's digs. I skipped lectures. I sneaked to London and elsewhere. I conducted several love affairs simultaneously. I had dreadful interviews with Mr. Harrison. I translated into Russian a score of poems by Rupert Brooke, Alice in Wonderland, and Romain Rolland's Corla Brignon. Scholastically, I might as well have gone up to the Inst MM of Tirana. Such things as the hot muffins and crumpets one had with one's tea after games, or the newsboys' cockneyish cries of Piper, Piper, mingling with the bicycle bells in the darkening streets, seemed to me at the time more characteristic of Cambridge than they do now. I cannot help realizing that, aside from striking but more or less transient customs, and deeper than ritual or rule, there did exist the residual something about Cambridge that many a solemn alumnus has tried to define. I see this basic property as the constant awareness one had of an untrammeled extension of time. I do not know if anyone will ever go to Cambridge in search of the imprints which the teat cleats on my soccer boots have left in the black mud before a gaping goal, or follow the shadow of my cap across the quadrangle to my tutor's stairs. But I know that I thought of Milton and Marvel and Marlowe with more than a tourist's thrill as I passed beside the reverend walls. Nothing one looked at was shut off in terms of time. Everything was a natural opening into it, so that one's mind grew accustomed to work in a particularly pure and ample environment, and because in terms of space, the narrow lane, the cloistered lawn, the dark archway hampered one physically, that yielding diaphanous texture of time was by contrast especially welcome to the mind, just as a sea view from a window exhilarates one hugely, even though one does not care for sailing. I had no interest whatever in the history of the place, and was quite sure that Cambridge was in no way affecting my soul, although actually it was Cambridge that supplied not only the casual frame, but also the very colors and inner rhythms for my very special Russian thoughts. Environment, I suppose, does act upon a creature if there is, in that creature, already a certain responsive particle or strain, the English I had imbibed in my childhood. Of this I had my first inkling just before leaving Cambridge, during my last and saddest spring there, when I suddenly felt that something in me was as naturally in contact with my immediate surroundings as it was with my Russian past, and that this state of harmony had been reached at the very moment that the careful reconstruction of my artificial but beautifully exact Russian world had been at last completed. I think one of the very few practical actions I have ever been guilty of was to use part of that crystalline material to obtain an honors degree. 5. I remember the dreamy flow of punts and canoes on the Cam, the Hawaiian whine of phonographs slowly passing through sunshine and shade, and a girl's hand gently twirling this way and that the handle of her peacock bright parasol as she reclined on the cushions of the punt which I dreamily navigated. The pink-coned chestnuts were in full fan. They made overlapping masses along the banks. They crowded the sky out of the river, and their special pattern of flowers and leaves produced a kind of en escalier effect, the angular figuration of some splendid green and old rose tapestry. The air was as warm as in the Crimea, with the same sweet, fluffy smell of a certain flowering bush that I never could quite identify. I later caught whiffs of it in the gardens of the southern states. The three arches of an Italianate bridge spanning the narrow stream combined to form, with the help of their almost perfect, almost unrippled replicas in the water, three lovely ovals. In its turn, the water cast a patch of lacy light on the stone of the intrados under which one's gliding craft passed. Now and then, shed by a blossoming tree, a petal would come down, 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 and with the odd feeling of seeing something neither worshipper nor casual spectator ought to see, one would manage to glimpse its reflection, which swiftly, more swiftly than the petal fell, rose to meet it, and for the fraction of a second one feared that the trick would not work, that the blessed oil would not catch fire, that the reflection might miss and the petal float away alone. But every time the delicate union did take place, with the magic precision of a poet's word meeting halfway his or a reader's recollection. When, after an absence of almost 17 years, I revisited England, I made the dreadful mistake of going to see Cambridge again, not at the glorious end of the Easter term, but on a raw February day that reminded me only of my own confused old nostalgia. I was hopelessly trying to find an academic job in England. The ease with which I obtained that type of employment in the USA is to me, in back thought, a constant source of grateful wonder. In every way, the visit was not a success. I had lunch with Nesbitt at a little place which ought to have been full of memories, but which, owing to various changes, was not. He had given up smoking. Time had softened his features, and he no longer resembled Gorky or Gorky's translator, but looked a little like Ibsen, minus the simian vegetation. An accidental worry. The cousin or maiden sister who kept house for him had been removed to Binet's clinic or something, seemed to prevent him from concentrating on the very personal and urgent matter I wanted to speak to him about. Bound volumes of Punch were heaped on a table in a kind of small vestibule, where a bowl of goldfish had formerly stood, and it all looked so different. Different, too, were the garish uniforms worn by the waitresses, of whom none was as pretty as the particular one I remembered so clearly. Rather desperately, as if struggling against boredom, Ibsen launched into politics. I knew well what to expect, denunciation of Stalinism. In the early 20s, Nesbitt had mistaken his own ebullient idealism for a romantic and humane something in Lenin's ghastly rule. Ibsen, in the days of the no less ghastly Stalin, was mistaking a quantitative increase in his own knowledge for a qualitative change in the Soviet regime. The thunderclap of purges that had affected old Bolsheviks, the heroes of his youth, had given him a salutary shock, something that in Lenin's day all the groans coming from the Solovki forced labor camp or the Lubyanka dungeon had not been able to do. With horror he pronounced the names of Yershkov and Yagoda, but quite forgot their predecessors, Uritsky and Dzerzhinsky. While time had improved his judgment regarding contemporaneous Soviet affairs, he did not bother to reconsider the preconceived notions of his youth, and still saw in Lenin's short reign a kind of glamorous quinquennium Neronis. He looked at his watch, and I looked at mine, and we parted. And I wandered around the town in the rain, and then visited the backs, and for some time peered at the rooks in the black network of the bare elms, and at the first crocuses in the mist-beaded turf. As I strolled under those sung trees, I tried to put myself into the same ecstatically reminiscent mood in regard to my student years as during those years I had experienced in regard to my boyhood, but all I could evoke were fragmentary little pictures. M.K., a Russian dyspeptically cursing the after-effects of a college hall dinner. N.R., another Russian romping about like a child. P.M., storming into my room with a copy of Ulysses freshly smuggled from Paris. J.C., quietly dropping in to say that he too had just lost his father. R.C., charmingly inviting me to join him on a trip to the Swiss Alps. Christopher, something or other, wriggling out of a proposed tennis double upon learning that his partner was to be a Hindu. T, a very old and fragile waiter, spilling the soup in hall on Professor A. E. Hausman, who then abruptly stood up as one shooting out of a trance. S.S., who was in no way connected with Cambridge, but who, having dozed off in his chair at a literary party in Berlin, and being nudged by a neighbor, also stood up suddenly in the middle of a story someone was reading. Lewis Carroll's Dormouse unexpectedly starting to tell a tale. E. Harrison unexpectedly making me a present of The Shropshire Lad, a little volume of verse about young males and death. The dull day had dwindled to a pale yellow streak in the gray west when, acting upon an impulse, I decided to visit my old tutor. Like a sleepwalker, I mounted the familiar steps and automatically knocked on the half-open door bearing his name. In a voice that was a jot less abrupt and a trifle more hollow, he bade me come in. "I wonder if you remember me," I started to say as I crossed the dim room to where he sat near a comfortable fire. "Let me see," he said, slowly turning around in his low chair. "I do not quite seem..." There was a dismal crunch, a fatal clatter. I had stepped into the tea-things that stood at the foot of his wicker chair. "Oh, yes, of course," he said. "I know who you are." Chapter 14 1 The spiral is a spiritualized circle. In the spiral form, the circle, uncoiled, unwound, has ceased to be vicious. It has been set free. I thought this up when I was a schoolboy, and I also discovered that Hegel's triadic series, so popular in old Russia, expressed merely the essential spirality of all things in their relation to time. Twirl follows twirl, and every synthesis is the thesis of the next series. If we consider the simplest spiral, three stages may be distinguished in it, corresponding to those of the triad. We can call thetic the small curve or arc that initiates the convolution centrally. Antithetic, the larger arc that faces the first in the process of continuing it. And synthetic, the still ampler arc that continues the second while following the first along the outer side, and so on. A colored spiral in a small ball of glass. This is how I see my own life. The 20 years I spent in my native Russia, 1899 to 1919, take care of the thetic arc. 21 years of voluntary exile in England, Germany, and France, 1919 to 1940, supply the obvious antithesis. The period spent in my adopted country, 1940 to 1960, forms a synthesis and a new thesis. For the moment, I am concerned with my antithetic stage, and more particularly with my life in continental Europe after I had graduated from Cambridge in 1922. As I look back at those years of exile, I see myself and thousands of other Russians leading an odd but by no means unpleasant existence in material indigence and intellectual luxury among perfectly unimportant strangers, spectral Germans and Frenchmen in whose more or less illusory cities we émigrés happened to dwell. These aborigines were to the mind's eye as flat and transparent as figures cut out of cellophane, and although we used their gadgets, applauded their clowns, picked their roadside plums and apples, no real communication of the rich human sort so widespread in our own midst existed between us and them. It seemed at times that we ignored them the way an arrogant or very stupid invader ignores a formless and faceless mass of natives. But occasionally, quite often in fact, the spectral world through which we serenely paraded our sores and our arts would produce a kind of awful convulsion and show us who was the discarnate captive and who the true lord. Our utter physical dependence on this or that nation, which had coldly granted us political refuge, became painfully evident when some trashy visa, some diabolical identity card, had to be obtained or prolonged, for then an avid bureaucratic hell would attempt to close upon the petitioner, and he might wilt while his dossier waxed fatter and fatter in the desks of rat-whiskered consuls and policemen. Documenti, it has been said, is a Russian placenta. The League of Nations equipped émigrés who had lost their Russian citizenship with a so-called Nansen passport, a very inferior document of a sickly green hue. Its holder was little better than a criminal on parole, and had to go through most hideous ordeals every time he wished to travel from one country to another, and the smaller the countries, the worse the fuss they made. Somewhere at the back of their glands, the authorities secreted the notion that no matter how bad a state, say, Soviet Russia might be, any fugitive from it was intrinsically despicable since he existed outside a national administration, and therefore he was viewed with the preposterous disapproval with which certain religious groups regard a child born out of wedlock. Not all of us consented to be bastards and ghosts. Sweet are the recollections some Russian emigres treasure, of how they insulted or fooled high officials at various ministries, prefectures, and Polizei presidiums. In Berlin and Paris, the two capitals of exile, Russians formed compact colonies with a coefficient of culture that greatly surpassed the cultural mean of the necessarily more diluted foreign communities among which they were placed. Within those colonies, they kept to themselves. I have in view, of course, Russian intellectuals, mostly belonging to democratic groups, and not the flashier kind of person who was, you know, advisor to the Tsar or something, that American club women immediately think of whenever white Russians are mentioned. Life in those settlements was so full and intense that these Russian intellienti, a word that had more socially idealistic and less highbrow connotations than intellectuals as used in America, had neither time nor reason to seek ties beyond their own circle. Today, in a new and beloved world where I have learned to feel at home as easily as I have ceased barring my sevens, extroverts, and cosmopolitans to whom I happen to mention these past matters think I am jesting, or accuse me of snobbery in reverse when I maintain that in the course of almost one-fifth of a century spent in Western Europe, I have not had, among the sprinkling of Germans and Frenchmen I knew, mostly landladies and literary people, more than two good friends all told. Somehow, during my secluded years in Germany, I never came across those gentle musicians of yore who, in Turgenev's novels, played their rhapsodies far into the summer night, or those happy old hunters with their captures pinned to the crown of their hats, of whom the Age of Reason made such fun, La Bruyère's gentleman who sheds tears over a parasitized caterpillar, Gay's philosophers more grave than wise, who, if you please, hunt science down in butterflies, and, less insultingly, Pope's curious Germans, who hold so rare those insects fair, or simply the so-called wholesome and kindly folks that during the last war homesick soldiers from the Middle West seem to have preferred so much to the cagey French farmer and to brisk Madeleine II. On the contrary, the most vivid figure I find when sorting out in memory the meager stack of my non-Russian and non-Jewish acquaintances in the years between the two wars is the image of a young German university student, well-bred, quiet, bespectacled, whose hobby was capital punishment. At our second meeting, he showed me a collection of photographs, among which was a purchased series. Ein bisschen retouchier, he said, wrinkling his freckled nose, that depicted the successive stages of a routine execution in China. He commented, very expertly, on the splendor of the lethal sword, and on the spirit of perfect cooperation between headsman and victim, which culminated in a veritable geyser of mist-gray blood spouting from the very clearly photographed neck of the decapitated party. Being pretty well off, this young collector could afford to travel, and travel he did, in between the humanities he studied for his Ph.D. He complained, however, of continuous ill luck, and added that if he did not see something really good soon, he might not stand the strain. He had attended a few passable hangings in the Balkans, and a well-advertised, although rather bleak and mechanical, guillotinade, he liked to use what he thought was colloquial French, on the Boulevard Arago in Paris. But somehow he never was sufficiently close to observe everything in detail, and the highly expensive teeny-weeny camera in the sleeve of his raincoat did not work as well as he had hoped. Despite a bad cold, he had journeyed to Regensburg, where beheading was violently performed with an axe. He had expected great things from that spectacle, but to his intense disappointment, the subject had apparently been drugged, and had hardly reacted at all, beyond feebly flopping about on the ground, while the masked executioner and his clumsy mate fell all over him. Dietrich, my acquaintance's first name, hoped some day to go to the States so as to witness a couple of electrocutions. From this word, in his innocence, he derived the adjective cute, which he had learned from a cousin of his who had been to America, and with a little frown of wistful worry, Dietrich wondered if it were really true that during the performance sensational puffs of smoke issued from the natural orifices of the body. At our third and last encounter, there still remained bits of him I wanted to file for possible use, he related to me, more in sorrow than in anger, that he had once spent a whole night patiently watching a good friend of his who had decided to shoot himself and had agreed to do so in the roof of the mouth, facing the hobbyist in a good light, but having no ambition or sense of honor, had got hopelessly tight instead. Although I have lost track of Dietrich long ago, I can well imagine the look of calm satisfaction in his fish-blue eyes, as he shows nowadays, perhaps at the very minute I am writing this, a never-expected profusion of treasures to his thigh-clapping, guffawing co-veterans, the absolutely wunderbar pictures he took during Hitler's reign. 2. I have sufficiently spoken of the gloom and the glory of exile in my Russian novels, and especially in the best of them, Dar, recently published in English as The Gift. But a quick recapitulation here may be convenient. With a very few exceptions, all liberal-minded creative forces, poets, novelists, critics, historians, philosophers, and so on, had left Lenin's and Stalin's Russia. Those who had not were either withering away there or adulterating their gifts by complying with the political demands of the state. What the Tsars had never been able to achieve, namely the complete curbing of minds to the government's will, was achieved by the Bolsheviks in no time after the main contingent of the intellectuals had escaped abroad or had been destroyed. The lucky group of expatriates could now follow their pursuits with such utter impunity that, in fact, they sometimes asked themselves if the sense of enjoying absolute mental freedom was not due to their working in an absolute void. True, there was among émigrés a sufficient number of good readers to warrant the publication in Berlin, Paris, and other towns of Russian books and periodicals on a comparatively large scale. But since none of those writings could circulate within the Soviet Union, the whole thing acquired a certain air of fragile unreality. The number of titles was more impressive than the number of copies any given work sold, and the names of the publishing houses, Orion, Cosmos, Logos, and so forth, had the hectic, unstable, and slightly illegal appearance that firms issuing astrological or facts-of-life literature have. In serene retrospect, however, and judged by artistic and scholarly standards alone, the books produced in vacuo by émigré writers seem today, whatever their individual faults, more permanent and more suitable for human consumption than the slavish, singularly provincial and conventional streams of political consciousness that came during those same years from the pens of young Soviet authors whom a fatherly state provided with ink, pipes, and pullovers. The editor of the Daily Rule, and the publisher of my first books, Yosif Vladimirovich Hessen, allowed me with great leniency to fill his poetry section with my unripe rhymes. Blue evenings in Berlin, the corner chestnut in flower, lightheadedness, poverty, love, the tangerine tinge of premature shop lights, and an animal aching yearn for the still fresh reek of Russia. All this was put into meter, copied out in longhand, and carted off to the editor's office, where myopic Ivy would bring the new poem close to his face, and after this brief, more or less tactual act of cognition, put it down on his desk. By 1928, my novels were beginning to bring a little money in German translations, and in the spring of 1929, you and I went butterfly hunting in the Pyrenees. But only at the end of the 1930s did we leave Berlin for good, although long before that I used to take trips to Paris for public readings of my stuff. Quite a feature of émigré life, in keeping with its itinerant and dramatic character, was the abnormal frequency of those literary readings in private houses or hired halls. The various types of performers stand out very distinctly in the puppet show going on in my mind. There was the faded actress, with eyes like precious stones, who, having pressed for a moment a clenched handkerchief to a feverish mouth, proceeded to evoke nostalgic echoes of the Moscow Art Theater by subjecting some famous piece of verse to the action, half-dissection, and half-caress of her slow, limpid voice. There was the hopelessly second-rate author, whose voice trudged through a fog of rhythmic prose, and one could watch the nervous trembling of his poor, clumsy, but careful fingers every time he tucked the page he had finished under those to come, so that his manuscript retained throughout the reading its appalling and pitiful thickness. There was the young poet in whom his envious brethren could not help seeing a disturbing streak of genius as striking as the stripe of a skunk, erect on the stage, pale and glazed-eyed, with nothing in his hands to anchor him to this world, he would throw back his head and deliver his poem in a highly irritating, rolling chant, and stop abruptly at the end, slamming the door of the last line and waiting for applause to fill the hush. And there was the old cher maître, dropping pearl by pearl an admirable tale he had read innumerable times, and always in the same manner, wearing the expression of fastidious distaste that his nobly furrowed face had in the frontispiece of his collected works. I suppose it would be easy for a detached observer to poke fun at all those hardly palpable people who imitated in foreign cities a dead civilization, the remote, almost legendary, almost Sumerian mirages of St. Petersburg and Moscow, 1900 to 1916, which even then in the 20s and 30s sounded like 1916 to 1900 BC. But at least they were rebels, as most major Russian writers had been ever since Russian literature had existed. And true to this insurgent condition which their sense of justice and liberty craved for as strongly as it had done under the oppression of the Tsars, émigrés regarded as monstrously un-Russian and subhuman the behavior of pampered authors in the Soviet Union. The servile response on the part of those authors to every shade of every governmental decree. For the art of prostration was growing there in exact ratio to the increasing efficiency of first Lenin's, then Stalin's political police. And the successful Soviet writer was the one whose fine ear caught the soft whisper of an official suggestion long before it had become a blare. Owing to the limited circulation of their works abroad, even the older generation of émigré writers, whose fame had been solidly established in pre-revolution Russia, could not hope that their books would make a living for them. Writing a weekly column for an émigré paper was never quite sufficient to keep body and pen together. Now and then, translations into other languages brought an unexpected scoop, but otherwise, grants from various émigré organizations, earnings from public readings, and lavish private charity were responsible for prolonging elderly authors' lives. Younger, less known but more adaptable writers supplemented chance subsidies by engaging in various jobs. I remember teaching English and tennis. Patiently, I thwarted the persistent knack Berlin businessmen had of pronouncing business so as to rhyme with dizziness, and like a sick automaton, under the slow-moving clouds of a long summer day on dusty courts, I ladled ball after ball over the net to their tanned, bob-haired daughters. I got $5, quite a sum during the inflation in Germany, for my Russian Alice in Wonderland. I helped compile a Russian grammar for foreigners in which the first exercise began with the words, Madame, ya doktor, vot banan. Madam, I am the doctor, here is a banana. Best of all, I used to compose for a daily émigré paper, the Berlin Rule, the first Russian crossword puzzles, which I baptized Krestoslovitsi. I find it strange to recall that freak existence. Deeply beloved of blurbists is the list of more or less earthy professions that a young author, writing about life and ideas which are so much more important, of course, than mere art, has followed. Newspaper boy, soda jerk, monk, wrestler, foreman in a steel mill, bus driver, and so on. Alas, none of these callings has been mine. My passion for good writing put me in close contact with various Russian authors abroad. I was young in those days and much more keenly interested in literature than I am now. Current prose and poetry, brilliant planets and pale galaxies, flowed by the casement of my garret night after night. There were independent authors of diverse age and talent, and there were groupings and cliques within which a number of young or youngish writers, some of them very gifted, clustered around a philosophizing critic. The most important of these mystagogues combined intellectual talent and moral mediocrity, an uncanny sureness of taste in modern Russian poetry, and a patchy knowledge of Russian classics. His group believed that neither a mere negation of Bolshevism nor the routine ideals of Western democracies were sufficient to build a philosophy upon which émigré literature could lean. They thirsted for a creed, as a jailed drug addict thirsts for his pet heaven. Rather pathetically, they envied Parisian Catholic groups for the season's subtleties that Russian mysticism so obviously lacked. Dostoevskian drisk could not compete with neo-Thomist thought. But were there not other ways? The longing for a system of faith, a constant teetering on the brink of some accepted religion, was found to provide a special satisfaction of its own. Only much later in the 40s did some of those writers finally discover a definite slope down which to slide in a more or less genuflectory attitude. This slope was the enthusiastic nationalism that could call a state, Stalin's Russia in this case, good and lovable for no other reason than because its army had won a war. In the early 30s, however, the nationalistic precipice was only faintly perceived, and the mystagogues were still enjoying the thrills of slippery suspension. In their attitude toward literature, they were curiously conservative. With them, soul-saving came first, log-rolling next, and art last. A retrospective glance nowadays notes the surprising fact of these free belles-lettrists abroad aping fettered thought at home by decreeing that to be a representative of a group or an epoch was more important than to be an individual writer. Vladislav Hodasiewicz used to complain in the 20s and 30s that young émigré poets had borrowed their art from him while following the leading cliques in modish angoisse and soul reshaping. I developed a great liking for this bitter man, wrought of irony and metallic-like genius, whose poetry was as complex a marvel as that of Tutchev or Bloch. He was physically of a sickly aspect, with contemptuous nostrils and beetling brows, and when I conjure him up in my mind, he never rises from the hard chair on which he sits, his thin legs crossed, his eyes glittering with malevolence and wit, his long fingers screwing into a holder the half of a Caporal Ver cigarette. There are few things in modern world poetry comparable to the poems of his heavy lyre. But unfortunately for his fame, the perfect frankness he indulged in when voicing his dislikes made him some terrible enemies among the most powerful critical coteries. Not all the mystagogues were Dostoevsky and Alyoshas. There were also a few Smerdyakovs in the group, and Hodasiewicz's poetry was played down with the thoroughness of a revengeful racket. Another independent writer was Ivan Bunin. I had always preferred his little-known verse to his celebrated prose. Their interrelation within the frame of his work recalls Hardy's case.